Okay, well, good morning, everyone. My name is Eddie. I'm one of the tutors at Langri Tangpa Centre, and we're engaged in the study of Dharma, and particularly this topic called presenting the path. So when you study Dharma, it's important to be relaxed, but also alert. So if you need to, please adjust your posture until your back is nice and straight. Your shoulders are relaxed. And as you breathe normally and naturally, you're aware of the movements that take place in the chest or the lower abdomen. And so we allow ourselves to breathe normally and naturally. And as the body and mind take on the state of relaxation, imagine the spiritual families of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas arrive from the 10 directions and are present in the space above you. And that every sentient being is sitting around you. And every one of them is related to you as a parent, an uncle or aunt, brother, sister, or child. And your happiness has always depended upon their kindness. And while they too wished to be happy and equally to avoid suffering, every one of them has never been genuinely happy. But now that we have come across the auspicious causes and conditions to awaken, form the resolve to quickly attain for them the state of enlightenment. And by doing so, turn their mind to the truth, to practice the truth as a path, and to remove obstacles from the path. By purifying their confusion into wisdom, thereby revealing their natural birthright, a state of unchanging goodness. And so, to help us accomplish this, we're going to take refuge in the families of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas above us and generate the mind of enlightenment. Perhaps placing your hands together in the prayer mudra. So you recite along with me. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Then I'm stabilizing and increasing this wish to bring about enlightenment for others, we can recite the four immeasurables. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others, we need to accumulate all the causes and conditions that bring that about, and then purify the mind of everything that hinders our enlightenment. The practices to do that are all summed up in the 7-limb prayer, which we can recite now. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Now, perhaps the greatest obstacle to enlightenment for the benefit of others is we call clinging to the sense of self, clinging to the phenomena of the world, clinging to our own ideas. So here we're going to let go of all that clinging by making an offering to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us. And in the absence of the clinging, imagine that your body and all the merits transform into a wonderful pure land where all beings can abide and take teachings from you as an enlightened being. So the short mandala. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niratayami. So the offering has been released and it's been accepted by the enlightened beings in front of us and above us, and they smile at us with delight. Then the vast refuge field begins to dissolve into light, melting into the central figure of Shakyamuni Buddha, who becomes very small but very bright, and who moves through space to abide above the crown of your head, facing the same way you are. Then he descends through space, entering the crown of your head, entering your body, and coming down to the level of your heart, whereby the light begins to expand, filling your body and mind. Light expands further, going out through the pores of your skin into the 10 directions of space. And wherever there are sentient beings within space, they are touched by that light and immediately transformed to be fully awakened, enlightened beings. And the body of each of these beings, once again, radiant light rays fill all of space. So here the artificial barriers between self and others, between you and I, between inner and outer, have vanished. And we rest in the radiant openness. And resting in that open radiance, breathe normally and naturally. Now the radiance begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space, once again entering your body at the level of the heart. You feel yourself embodied and sitting on your seat, breathing normally and naturally. And you recognize that you have the potential to fully awaken for the benefit of others, because this is the natural potential of the mind. And that you're willing to cultivate this potential and to develop it fully, thereby bringing about your own welfare and the welfare of every other living being. And as one of the means to do that, you're engaged in these teachings of the presentation of the path. And you're breathing normally and naturally, and you gently allow your eyes to open, and you acknowledge where you are. Okay, so now I'm going to share the screen and begin with our class. So you can see here we're up to class number 5, and we're going to have a look now at some of the material we've covered. So we're up to class 5. Now, in the first two teachings, we looked at the paths practiced in the three levels of an individual. So these three levels are called the three scopes. And we've acknowledged that there are three scopes or three capacities for a practitioner to engage in the path. But we also became aware of three principal aspects of the complete path called renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. Within those first two verses that we've covered, we also looked at like the initial level practices. Now, those were to acknowledge that you have a human body with the conditions that can allow you to become enlightened. How it's necessary to rely upon a teacher, and the process of meditation that will be required of you to actually engage in each stage of the path. So in brief, we've covered like these five verses. So the first two, like I said, they really covered the preparatory or initial level practices of the being of the small scope. Then we also looked at the beings of the middle scope, those who are really concerned with freeing themselves completely from the cycle of an existence controlled by karma and delusion. And that wish to be free is called renunciation. So in brief, we've sort of answered 9 questions of the suggested public exam and 11 questions of the assessment exam. So these two exams you'll see in the material that you can download at the from the members area that Miffy's put up there. Now today we're going to look at the practices of the person of great scope, in other words, the advanced level of practitioner. So here we're really looking at the mind of enlightenment, which is also known as bodhicitta, that which prevents the development of that mind, called self-cherishing, and its opposite, cherishing others. We'll also look at the preliminary to these practices called equanimity. And as well as that, we'll be looking at verses 6 and 7. So in brief, in today's topic, we'll be answering questions 9 and 10 of the suggested public exam, and questions 12, 13, and 14 of the assessment questions.
Eddie, I'm going to jump in there. When you say suggested public exam, everybody can relax. We do the exams whichever way you like. You can write an essay. You can email Eddie questions. You can have a chat. It can be, you know, one-on-one. There's, it doesn't have to be public.
And yeah, that's right. It's just called public. It's not actually public. Especially in times like what we're going through at the moment. So anyway, these are the books I've relied upon. So on that top row, this is these new series of books called The Library of Wisdom and Compassion. These books are all written by the His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Chodron. And they are fantastic. They've been written specifically for a Western audience who are sort of serious about their Dhamma study, but they're like preliminaries before a person would engage in the study of the Great Lam Rim, written by Lama Tsongkhapa, that you would normally get a commentary on from a Geshe. What's fantastic about these five books is they've also got a lot of material in there that's not actually in the Lam Rim, but it's fantastic for us. It really forms a great foundation. And there's still more of these books to come. They're very easy to read, and they have a wealth of information. Down here, this book called Medicine for the Mind. So this is a commentary on the three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment. It also has a great commentary on Buddha nature. And it's written by our own Geshe Tashi Tsering, who has a center in Brisbane also. All four next books, with two of them here by His Holiness the Dalai Lama again, also have commentaries on the three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment. You know, they're terrific. They all come at this topic in slightly different ways, and I've found them myself really, really useful. So now we're going to come and have a look at the first verse here, verse 6 in the text, Three Principal Aspects of the Path. So here Lama Tsongkhapa says, unless it's driven by pure bodhicitta, renunciation will never become a cause for the perfect happiness of highest enlightenment. Therefore, intelligent beings cultivate supreme bodhicitta. So in relation to this, this is what His Holiness the Dalai Lama says from the book The Essence of Tsongkhapa's Teachings, which is a commentary on these three principal aspects. So however strong your familiarity with the determination to be free of cyclic existence, you know, what we know as renunciation, unless you generate an altruistic attitude, strong wish to benefit sentient beings, it will be impossible for you to attain enlightenment. In this regard, Nagarjuna says in his precious garland, if you and this world wish to actualize supreme enlightenment, its root is the mind of enlightenment, called bodhicitta. Now, the basis for generating an altruistic aspiration for enlightenment is compassion, in particular, great compassion, of which there are many types. So one kind of compassion is to think how nice it would be if all sentient beings were free from sufferings. There are other degrees of compassion that not only include this thought, but also have greater courage within them. And this great courage induces a special resolve to take responsibility personally for getting rid of sentient beings' sufferings. Now there are, like you said here, there are a number of different forms of compassion. So I want to just mention a few of them. So one of them is the compassion that we normally have, that we all have right now. So we don't like suffering and we wish to be free of it. So this is a sense of compassion extended towards ourselves. We also do not wish those who are close to us, family, children, people we care for, friends and so forth, to experience suffering. And this is sort of like I said, this is the natural compassion we are naturally endowed with. We wish that others do not experience hurt, pain and suffering. What's required of us is to actually build on that, use that as a foundation to strengthen it, looking at deeper and vaster forms of suffering that we probably weren't aware of that others experienced, and also wish them to be free of those forms of suffering too. So that's where we are probably at the moment. Now, when persons develop genuine renunciation and engage in a path to bring about their own liberation, their compassion is greater than our ordinary compassion. And that's because their scope is vaster and their way of seeing is deeper than ours. So they don't look just at their family members and close friends. They look at everyone and seeing that everybody is experiencing different forms of suffering, and in particular themselves, how deep their own suffering goes. And they wish to be free of suffering themselves. So they don't hurt others because they understand that others do not wish to experience suffering, and they would try to help others be free from suffering by giving them advice and perhaps teaching them and so forth. So in relationship to this, His Holiness says again, "Now the compassion generated by the hearers and the solitary Buddhas is of a much higher quality than the compassion we normally generate, because seeing the suffering that pervades the whole of cyclic existence, they generate compassion for all sentient beings." Now, the compassion generated by the bodhisattvas is of the highest kind. They not only wish that sentient beings be separated from suffering, but also voluntarily take responsibility for ridding them of their sufferings. And this is called great compassion. It's this compassion that underlies the altruistic aspiration for enlightenment and that induces what we call the special attitude. As for this reason, we often come across statements in the scriptures that say that compassion acts as the root of the mind of enlightenment.
So Eddie, would an example of an analogy of this be like how we have the first responders, you know, that rush to the aid of sentient beings, you know, putting their welfare first, like, you know, ambulance people or firemen or whatever. So the bodhisattvas are like the first responders about samsara.
If it's a helpful analogy, you could use that. They could see, you know, like you say, those people, the first responders, see that others are suffering and they have a wish to put an end to that suffering, and they're out there like doing the best they can to do that. So, yep, it's an analogy that could work for you.
Yep, okay.
So there's a little thing here which we'll come up to, I think next week, with this word pure bodhicitta. So we'll have a look at that, or probably the next two slides, but certainly next week as well. So sometimes it's asked in classes where the teacher, especially if they're Tibetan teachers or Geshes, will point out the difference between renunciation and bodhicitta, and then ask, if a person has bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, do they have renunciation? So we're going to have a look at that next. The answer is, renunciation is subsumed within bodhicitta. So in other words, if you have bodhicitta, you definitely have renunciation. So let's have a look at that and what this means. So renunciation, first of all, is concerned with oneself. Oneself wants to be liberated from all of the sufferings of cyclic existence. So they have a renunciation, they have a willingness to let go or to give up the causes that produce all the sufferings that take place in cyclic existence. And this has come about because they have a very deep and pure compassion directed at themselves. And this compassion is imbued with wisdom, knowing that they can actually be freed of cyclic existence and the causes that generate its production. Is this clear to everyone, or have I spoken too much like Dharma talk gobbledygook? Do you guys sort of get it?
It sounds a little technical.
Okay. So to have pure renunciation, we have to actually want to stop our own suffering. To bring about the end of our own suffering, we have to find out what produces it, what the causes are of it. We have to be able to see that those causes can actually be abandoned and we could be free of every form of suffering.
So that's like the difference between just wishing we were free of suffering and actually finding what the reason we're suffering and what we can do about it.
That's right. Yeah. And then, doing it.
So, you know, because just in terms of COVID, you know, and Trump has said, you know, we're sick of the virus now. So that's kind of like being sick of the suffering, but not actually finding out what the cause is or what we can do to protect ourselves. Right. Just like, we're over it now. We're finished.
Yeah, that's right. So if we want, you know, if we actually wish to be free of COVID, we've actually got to find what causes it and destroy its causes. And then we will be free. And then we can go back to normal.
So just saying, I'm over it now, is like, it's not the end, is it?
That's the beginning.
Right.
So to say I'm over it is the beginning. Then all the work begins, doesn't it? You know, as we see all around the world, now all the scientists are all working to try and find out what causes it, trying to find a solution. So here it's the same with us. Our suffering is not just COVID. It's the grasping at true existence and all the disturbing emotions that follow from it, and then the habitual actions that we do to keep on, which keep producing our suffering.
So then Anthea is asking, so if we can recognize the causes of suffering within ourselves and are able to, you know, apply what we have to, then we've got the experience to be able to lead others by example.
Yeah, we will. Yeah, that's right. We have some knowledge because we know that we can attain our own freedom, and people aren't of great, you know, difference. We're all basically all the same. Yes, that's right, Anthea. But like it begins, like I said, with compassion directed at oneself. So compassion is a wish to be free from suffering. So it's directed at oneself. We know that we can be free of that suffering because it's imbued with wisdom. Now, if we couldn't be free, well, it would just have to remain a wish. We could actually be free. But we actually can be free. So we need to engage in the methods that will bring about that freedom. Right? So that's renunciation. Bodhicitta is when we, just like you're saying, you know, we extend our understanding of our own suffering and that we also can be, that we can be free of it. And then it's looking across at everyone else and going, well, they're sentient beings. Whatever, what produces their suffering is the same thing that produces my suffering. And I know it can be overcome. And actually, there's no real difference between me and others. The major difference between me and others is that there's so many more of them. I'm just one single person, whereas others are countless. Nevertheless, I'm going to freedom. So there we have, and then you go like, but you know, you think about it, you go, that's, well, I can't. He said, yeah, that's right. You cannot do it as a sentient being. But what about, how about being like an enlightened being? Because it's then that you would know the dispositions of each being and be able to show them the methods. Now, those people, all those beings, have to engage in the method. Just like with, if you use the example of COVID, if they do invent something that will, you know, some sort of antidote to COVID, and we take the antidote, then we tell everybody, you know, we have an antidote to COVID, and here it is. And we're well, you know, it's, unless they actually take the antidote, they will not be well. So just hearing that there is such an antidote and just knowing that there is somebody who is healthy, that was once suffering, but now they're healthy. Just seeing the healthy person, just seeing and hearing of their what they did will not be enough to be free of COVID. You will need to take the medication. So it's the same here. You know, Buddhas free others from suffering by giving them the teachings of Dharma. We as sentient beings have to take those teachings and engage in them. And then we can become free of our own suffering. Do you guys have anything? Is there anything else that we'd like to say?
There isn't yet.
Okay, so let's have a look at this. What this thing is? What? How bodhicitta is defined? Like, what is it? So, it's quite a mouthful here. Probably more than a mouthful, but we'll shorten it down in a couple of slides coming up. So, first of all, we can say it is a special mental main mind, which is the entryway to the Mahayana path. And is concomitant with its assistant aspiration that focuses on complete enlightenment for the benefit of others. So I'm going to take each of these little sections and just say it to you. If you wish to take notes, please do so. And then we'll break it down to be even shorter. So it is a. So what we mean by it's special, what makes it special? Well, it's one of the principal states of awareness required to attain enlightenment. And so there are other principal minds also that you need. So this is one of them. One of the principal states of awareness required to attain enlightenment. It is a mental consciousness. So it's not a sense consciousness. It's not like a visual consciousness or an auditory consciousness. It's mind. Mental main mind. And it is cultivated in dependence on meditation. Now it's also called like a main mind. So here we're talking about the differences between minds and mental factors. So a main mind will just focus on its object, and then you've got all these other factors that keep the mind there and support it. And they're the mental factors. But here it's like a mental consciousness, but it's been developed and cultivated in such a way. It's just the main mind. Now, if you have this mind, you have entered the Mahayana path. It's entry to it. It's the generation of it means you are now a Mahayanist or a Bodhisattva. Now this is, it is concomitant with its assistant aspiration. So from the point of view of its of function, consciousness, like I said, can be divided into main minds and mental factors. You see, every mind is connected or associated with various different mental factors. So some of the mental factors that go along with this mind will be great compassion, great love. So these are the mental factors, and they're supporting this main mind that is aspiring for enlightenment for the benefit of others. And then it says here, this assistant aspiration for the benefit of others.
Hang on, Eddie. So concomitant means?
Support, goes along with.
Right.
So here's just something sort of interesting that will also come up in classes occasionally with the Geshe's. They'll ask you this question. Yeah? So they'll ask you, does a Buddha have the aspiration for enlightenment? So you could say, no. Now, and there's a question like, why not? You say, because they are enlightened. They don't need to wish to become enlightened anymore. They are enlightened. But then you have other things going, well, we could say that, but then you could also argue that they do actually have the aspiration. Another thing to think of is that, you know, when we have aspirations, they're conceptual. They're like they're thought, aren't they? I want to become enlightened. Why are you doing this? I want to become enlightened. That's a thought, a conception. So Buddhas don't have conceptions. So you could say, okay, so you could, you know, argue that. Anyway, this is just something to bring up. But there's also another point of view that would say, no, the aspiration is still there. It just depends upon, I guess, the philosophical system you're coming from.
So is the aspiration like that, like a primal urge of a Buddha would be to enlighten or to help others?
Yeah, but it can't be like that's... so you're going to see the aspiration is to become enlightened for the benefit of others. Right? That's bodhicitta. To become enlightened for the benefit of others, for the sake of others wishing to attain complete and perfect enlightenment. So a Buddha is enlightened. They don't have to wish to become enlightened. So that's like one thing. But like a wish is a conceptual thing, is a thought. And also Buddhas are free of conception. Anyway, something to think about. So here we have a bit of advice now from Lama Ratisha. He says, one who wholly seeks a complete end to the entire suffering of others, because their suffering belongs to his own conscious stream, that person is a superior. So I'm sorry about that. There must be a word behind our big box here. One who wholly seeks the complete end to the entire suffering of others, because their suffering belongs to his own conscious stream, that person is a superior. So here we've got this line here, because their suffering belongs to his own conscious stream. So what do you think that means, anyone?
Their own experience.
Whose own experience, Miffy?
The superior.
Okay, yeah. Anyone else?
That they feel it themselves. No, but there is a question from Anne about does one have to be enlightened to be able to assist others to that state?
No.
So you've got to be...
No, we can be doing it right now.
We can start now.
Yeah.
But to... So we don't need to be a Buddha before assisting others, but if we want to assist others all the way to enlightenment, then we'd have
that's
to
become right. Buddha. And if you know, like, if you look at the way we assist people now, which we do, which we are trying to assist others to be much happier, to even bring about the, you know, the three principal aspects and so forth, you'll also know that your own ability to help right now is severely limited by your own lack of knowledge, your own lack of skills and so forth. But even though, you know, to be like perfect helper. And also remember that even though you might, you know, have all the means to help others and be a perfect helper like a Buddha, it does not follow that the person will take your advice.
So then there's a couple of answers to your first question about, so who, the mind stream of who.
Yeah.
So Sue has said the view of the transitory aggregates and only they, one's own view of the transitory aggregates and only they can remove it.
I'm not sure what she means by that.
As when you asked me about, the superior.
Okay, yeah, so we've got a, okay, so this person's called superior. If you go like, why are they superior? Because the suffering of others belongs to his own conscious stream. If we look back at before, those who aren't superior, those who are less than this, they have looked at their own suffering, right? And that belongs to their, they are aware of their own suffering and they strive for liberation from that. The superior person sees their own suffering, belongs to their own conscious stream, and knows everyone else is like that.
Right.
And they put their full awareness on that and going, damn, just as I need to free myself, I need to free them.
So Nicola has said, because all sentient beings are the same in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering.
Yep, this is right. And this person has, like I said, acknowledged that they want to be happy, but they're actually suffering. And they know how they're suffering, and they know how they can be free. Then he's turned around and looked at everyone who surrounds them and goes, all these beings are suffering.
And then Anthea said, so it's perspective that causes suffering or happiness?
Yeah, so what type of perspective, Anthea?
I'll just give her a moment to type back in again.
Yep.
And also Anne's kind of saying then also that it works both ways, both this feeling for others and feeling for oneself and working for Buddhahood, for, you know, liberation for oneself, but also Buddhahood for others works both ways.
I'm not sure what you mean by both ways here.
Whether we need to be a Buddha first before assisting others.
Yeah. So, you know, like we are at present assisting ourselves, but, you know, like we are a community, we could also assist one another. Yeah, but we have to be realistic about this and going, you know, our ability to help others, for instance, is much less than the ability of His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Geshe Sopa or Lama Zopa or Geshe Tashi Sering. And so those people have a superior ability to help. But, you know, if you look at them and go, well, but, you know, we don't know who's enlightened or who's not. But we have to begin with this intention to help others even more than we're sort of helping ourselves. But so that sort of intention is a superior intention than the intentions of others whose focus is just on themselves.
Okie dokie.
Okie dokie. So once again from the Dalai Lama, he says, so this is a verse about the paths of those who engage in the great scope, or the superior scope, for those of advanced capacity. The verse refers to those practitioners who generate compassion and love and kindness towards others because of a deep understanding of the nature of their own suffering. They understand that suffering comes into being as a result of the mental afflictions rooted in fundamental ignorance, and recognize that while they are under the control of these afflictions and the underlying ignorance, sufferings will continue to arise ceaselessly, like ripples on a lake. Once you understand the nature of suffering in relation to your own existence in this way, you can extend your understanding to see that all sentient beings suffer from the bondage of the afflictions. Reflecting on their suffering, you then cultivate the insight that just as you yourself want to be free from suffering, so do they. And this is how you begin to cultivate great compassion. When you generate the wish for all sentient beings to be happy, this is the start of loving kindness. With compassion, wishing to be free of suffering, and loving kindness, wishing others to be happy. With compassion, with wishing others to be free of suffering, and loving kindness, wishing others to be happy, you then generate a sense of special responsibility. Your compassion does not remain simply at the level of a wish or aspiration. You generate a sense of commitment. I myself shall liberate all beings from suffering. Eventually, this extraordinary sense of responsibility leads to the realization of bodhicitta, the altruistic intention of one who aspires to attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Thus, there are two kinds of aspiration in the realization of bodhicitta. The aspiration concerned for the welfare of all sentient beings, and the aspiration to attain Buddhahood for their sake. So in brief, bodhicitta is, for the sake of others, wishing to attain complete, perfect enlightenment. So we have the two aspirations here. For the sake of others, because you see their great suffering, you also understand that they could be free of it and have an authentic, genuine happiness. To do that, you yourself wish to attain complete and perfect enlightenment. So when these two aspirations finally come together spontaneously through different techniques of meditation, then the resulting mind is bodhicitta. So thus bodhicitta is one central mind accompanied by two mental factors, these two mental factors.
And sorry, the two mental factors are?
For the sake of others, because you've got the great compassion, then this wish to retain the aspiration. Enlightenment. Yeah.
Right, and so those two mental factors support
the mind of enlightenment.
Sorry? Right.
Yeah. Okay, so now how are we going to bring about this mind of enlightenment? So let's have a look at the... I hope you'll notice here where verse 6 is really talking about the importance of bodhicitta, how important it is to have that mind, because without it you can't become enlightened. So it's of supreme importance. You cannot enter the Mahayana path, but it's the entryway to becoming a Mahayanist. It's also the once you have it, you are now on the bodhisattva path. So that's how important it is. And that verse 6, is about the importance of it. Verse 3 was also about the importance of renunciation. So you've got importance and renunciation, now importance on bodhicitta. Verse 4 before also talked about what are the methods to develop renunciation. Verse 7, coming up right next slide, talks about the methods for developing the mind of enlightenment. So you've got sort of three verses, three for renunciation, three for bodhicitta. First beginning with importance, second with method, third with the measurement of the attainment. Do we actually have renunciation? Do we actually have bodhicitta? How do I know that? And there is a way of knowing it. Okay, so let's now have a look at the methods then, and this is in verse 7, where Lama Tsongkhapa is written, carried away by the torrents of four fierce rivers, bound by tight fetters of karma, difficult to undo, caught up in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped in the pitch-black darkness of ignorance. You know, verse 8 goes on, but it basically says, think about how your mothers feel. Think about what's happening to them. So this is really describing what it's actually, what's actually like in the deepest depths up to the surface of this thing we call cyclic existence or samsara. So the verse is sort of saying, you know, all sentient beings are carried away by four torrential rivers. And these four could refer to the four causes that project sentient beings into birth and cyclic existence, but they could also refer to their four results. And here, the four rivers are referring to the four results, being birth, aging, sickness, and death. So we find ourselves, you know, we're born into cyclic existence. While we're in it, we immediately begin aging. And throughout the process of aging, we become sick at different stages. And finally, this all culminates in death. And then it's repeated again and again and again. And what keeps it, this repetition is karma, habitual responses to being in cyclic existence. And these habits are really hard to undo. Caught up in the iron net of self-grasping, they're like, what is produced in the habitual response? It's self-grasping ignorance. And this ignorance pervades all of our senses. So we are blinded to the possibility of freedom. So the next slide, let's have a look at the next slide. So here we've got a wonderful little thing that I'll show you that Miffy put together with lots of work to do this. So here we see the person in the going down the river. And what's driving them, of course, is irreversible contaminated actions. And here they are. Here are the causes for finding, for us being in cyclic existence, the desire, the ripening of karma, the wrong views, and driving everything, of course, the ignorance. Now what it relates to, so desire is the cause for birth. Ripening karma is the cause for old age. Wrong views are the causes that produce the effect of sickness. And ignorance brings about death. So I'll just say a few things here. So this is a little bit intense, I guess. So here we're talking, so like I said before, what's the root cause of all of this? What's the root cause of all these, you know, contaminated actions of being irreversible and so forth? Really can come down to the ignorance. But it's a particular type of ignorance. It's the ignorance called self-grasping, grasping itself. So here we don't mean just the, you know, like we are persons and all persons have a self. We're not just talking about grasping at a sense of self that seems to be substantially existent and so forth. Is that all phenomena appear to be truly existent, existing in the way they appear to us. And this is where the view comes in. So if we have a wrong view, we agree with that. We think it's like that. And so then when it's like when you think that, then the causes of our suffering, causes of our happiness appear to be outside ourselves, and we act on those beliefs. driven by strong desire. So our misconception of the true existence of phenomena, meaning our body, our mind, our sense of self, and everything that our senses engage with. In other words, our strong grasping for the attraction of our physical body acts as the foundation for generating too much attachment to our own selves, to our own persons. Therefore, the misconception of phenomena acts as a foundation for the misconception of the person. Actually, Geshe Sopa was just saying this yesterday, of how the ignorance kicks off. It begins with the phenomena, meaning the aggregates, then we grasp itself. He says, when you observe the I in your own continuum and generate a feeling of I, a conception of a truly existent self arises, and this is called a view of the transitory collection. So the misconception of self of phenomena gives rise to this view of the transitory collection, and this in turn stimulates the accumulation of actions. You know, the function of a person is to act. Now, when the person is under the control of delusion and previous habitual responses to things, they will act unskillfully. They will act without actually seeing the true nature of things. When we do that, then we involuntarily take birth in cyclic existence at the time of death. And while we are alive, we experience the unceasing chain of sufferings like birth, aging, sickness, and death. So when we look at this, we can look at this picture of what I've said to generate a renunciation for cyclic existence. Because we can just see it's just pervaded with suffering. But you could also use this to develop bodhicitta, because if you recognize this is happening to you, you'll recognize it's happening to everyone else too. And then just as you've taken responsibility towards yourself, you have compassion towards yourself, you have love towards yourself. So you seek freedom from suffering and its causes. You could extend that love and kindness that you naturally extend towards yourself, the compassion that you naturally extend towards yourself, you could also extend it towards others with an intention to bring about their freedom. You realize you could only do that if you yourself knew all the methods completely and had brought about your own freedom. So you decide, I must become enlightened then. Then I can really help others most skillfully, most effortlessly, and continuously. Now, to develop this mind of enlightenment, there are a number of different methods. So how I'm going to briefly introduce to you those methods.
But hang on, Eddie, there's the rest of the picture.
Is there?
The bonds of karma and the net.
Oh, here we go. That's right. Thank you. So here we have this iron net, you can see, and then the cage. Thank you, Biffy. And then we have
the ignorance,
dark cloud of ignorance.
And there we are in the rapids of life, getting bounced along.
Yep.
So if you ever feel like this, folks, this is why.
And this is normal. This is the normal we're wishing for while we're in cyclic existence. Now, that's not a good wish to go back to normal.
So when we're wishing for normal, it's kind of like we're still in the net of self-cherishing, the bonds of karma, the darkness of ignorance, but we've just hit a quiet patch.
Yeah. So I guess what we might say when we're saying normal is that we have once again the opportunity to engage in a path for freedom. But yeah, like we already have that. We are human beings with the core, with the conditions already present to bring about our own enlightenment, to keep on engaging in a spiritual path. So COVID should not stop us doing that.
In fact, it might, COVID's kind of, can be a great motivator. It can help us.
Ooh. You know, in fact, a very good friend of ours very nearly died just recently, and she's been in and out of hospital, and she's still going back to hospital shortly. But she was saying it's been the very best thing that's happened to her, because she realized she did not have actual refuge. And she just noticed how much fear there was within her about her death, and having no control over her mind because she was so afraid. Now, since that's happened, she's always been practicing, but it was like this, you sort of think, you've got refuge, then you can discover you don't. So since that discovery, she's so much happier, it's for sure, and she's so much more right into Geshe's open stages of emptiness and the bodhicitta aspect. And that's so what's going to happen to us.
Anne is asking that the desire for normal is about ignorance.
Yeah, that's right. It's rooted in ignorance, and also a desire and attachment. But that's its actual root, Anne. That's right. So we can go back to our habitual ways of behavior. our views will be reaffirmed. And we can engage in our desire to get more money and work and, keep the economy going and all that sort of stuff. That's normal. Thank you for reminding me about this, Miffy. Otherwise, Sunday we would have had, I'll be going, what's going on? Okay. And thank you for all the work you put into it too. There was a lot of work gone into the slide. Let's look now at the methods for developing this mind of enlightenment. So we have uncommon and common methods. So the most common method for developing the mind of enlightenment is called Atisha's Seven Cause and Effect Personal Instruction and Shantideva's Equalized Exchanging Self for Others. These are two most common techniques. There are also other techniques also that don't go all through the seven cause and the different steps of Shantideva. And these techniques or methods are, when they're different than these two, they're really, that difference is highly dependent upon the relationship between the student and the teacher. Now, there's also an uncommon technique. This was brought about by the founder of our tradition, the Galupa tradition, of Lama Tsongkhapa, where he integrated these two techniques into what's called the 11-point method.
So, Eddie, often, it teaches seven cause and effect personal instruction is said to be the easiest one, and Shantideva is the most tricky. But I've found also, because people come to class at Langri Tumpa Center and are all different stages of discovering Buddhism, and that often, because a teacher's one is based on a really firm understanding of rebirth and mind, past and future rebirths, that's quite a difficult one to start with. And the equalizing, exchanging self with others makes more sense kind of from an intellectual point of view, which often beginners start off with.
Mm. Yeah, actually, it's also said that for those who have... Shantideva's one, equalized exchanging, requires a sense of intelligence, sharp intelligence, because you've really got to use wisdom realizing emptiness within that. Really helps you. Whereas Atisha's one is more sort of more towards the faith side, the method side. So Atisha's method and faith, Shantideva is wisdom and insight. And that's why Lama Tsongkhapa has integrated both. So when you learn of them, when you study them, you study, either this one or that one, Atisha's one or Shantideva's one. So you study them separately, so you're quite familiar of the structure of each, and you have enough knowledge to put it all together. But then when you come to actually practice it within meditation to actually develop a mind of enlightenment, then Lama Tsongkhapa's method is suggested to be better. But this integration of now faith and intelligence through method and wisdom.
Or even just with like really a really strong emotional engagement and the
That's
wisdom.
right. An emotion, really strong emotional engagement, but entwined with the wisdom. Yeah. So, it's like something for everyone here, and then combining them both. But also, like I said, I'd just remind you that as Geshe Sopra said a couple of Sundays ago, that there are a number, these are the major methods, the main methods, the most common and the uncommon, but there are others too. And these others are highly dependent upon, like you say, your relationship with the teacher. Now, you'll see that with these, whether it's a teacher's seven cores and personal instruction, there's one of the causes in there that's not actually in there. It's not included within the seven cores of effect, and it's called equanimity. So equanimity is a preliminary for Lama Ratisha's method. Shantideva has equanimity already in what is called equalizing. So we're going to look at equanimity next. So let's have a look at it. It's called immeasurable equanimity, because there are different forms of equanimity also. So here, I forgot who actually wrote this quote, but this is it. So impartiality is another word for equanimity. Impartiality is freedom from attachment and hostility. When sides and factions are all seen as equal, when enemy and friend and neither are all treated with an even-handed kindness. We should practice these four attitudes, remembering that all is without true existence. So this came from, I remember, a Nyingma practitioner, a great Nyingma practitioner, and I really liked it because it contains the four immeasurables in this. And this really, and also the equalizing and exchanging, and this great sense of, what it really is, like freedom from attachment and hostility.
And it's so nice how mentioning the even-handed kindness.
Yeah, because oftentimes, if you don't see equanimity in its context, it could appear to you that it's a sense of nothingness or dullness. You don't have any emotions at all. But the emotions that you don't have are these two, attachment and hostility. Now that's what we're moving out. So and out of the from this is this even-handed kindness. You might say, well, how come we've got even-handed kindness? Because the practices before this, in terms of the four immeasurables, are immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, and then immeasurable equanimity. So you have already compassion, loving kindness, and joy in the mind, right? What's not in the mind is attachment and hostility. So in relationship to this, this is from Alexander Berzin. He says, the equanimity discussed here is the equanimity that is developed in common with the practitioners of the modest vehicle, meaning not the vehicle of the Mahayana, but that which is lower than that, which means that it is an equanimity that is in common with the initial and intermediate levels of motivation. Because remember, the bodhicitta is built on those are the foundations, so we need the foundations. What's the aim of this equanimity practice? To overcome attraction to some people, repulsion or aversion to other people, and indifference to yet others. And others doesn't exclusively mean people. So we're talking about every type of sentient being. So that would be cockroaches, lice, alligators, sifting out hostility towards those things that appear freaky and threatening, and sifting out attachment to all those things that we think are just wonderful. Now, and the balancing of this mind is to prevent what we call a social reactivity to those we call friends, enemies, and strangers. And this is required to be like a stable foundation for the higher qualities of affectionate love, great compassion, and radical altruism. So in the Tibetan Buddhist training, this sense of evenness is the first step in the cultivation of the mind of enlightenment. And they give you lots of analogies about this. Now, sometimes they use about like painting a wall. Before you paint the wall, you've got to sand it down. You've got to prepare it for the paint. Other times they use an analogy of a garden, like before you plant your seeds, you've got to go into the earth, take out all the rocks, take out anything that will hinder the growth of your crop. And you get a nice, smooth piece of land so that the crops will grow well. And in relation to the house, you know, so you sand it down, you remove all the bumps, you take off all the old paint and the flakes, so the new paint will stick. And in the same way, what we're moving away out of from our minds, attachment and hostility. So these new aspirations, mind of enlightenment, kindness, love, and that will actually stick and not be blistered and removed through hostility or attachment. We have a question in the text, in these different exams, we'll say, you know, why develop impartiality? Now, you've got the answer in a couple of slides there. But basically, it's just to overcome the major sources of all our afflictions towards limited beings. So limited beings mean sentient beings just like ourselves, unenlightened beings. So what are the major sources of our afflictions, folks? Come on, what's the major sources? Sue, you know one of them for sure.
Sue said ignorance and karma.
Yeah, that's right. They're the major sources. And what else?
Anthea said desire, as has Alison. Yep. Maria has said bias. And yeah. Anne has said ignorance.
Yeah, so the major ones, as Sue has pointed out, are the self-grasping ignorance and karma. From that comes out every other form of affliction. And the major ones, the afflictions here are really concerned is the major ones of desirous attraction, or which is based on a biased desirous attachment, aversion, biased hostility, and indifference based on biased naivety. So when I say biased naivety, to defeat indifference, right? So when we look at other people and we are indifferent to their suffering, we have forgotten that they all have been related to us as family members, parents, relatives, that they're just the same as us in their wish to be happy. They're just the same as us in experiencing suffering. They're just the same as us, that it's these afflictions that are doing it. And so when you look around and you don't care about others, that's what's going on. It's, in other words, you're naive. Biased naivety produces the indifference which comes out of ignorance, not knowing or forgetting our knowledge. So now we're just going to have a couple of slides now just to sort of briefly look at the seven cause and effect instruction and the equalizing exchanging self. So we won't spend a lot of time on this. We just point out the steps you go through. So you can see here, in terms of the mothers recognizing all beings as family, to inspire commonality and solidarity with one another, recalling their kindness, inspiring gratitude towards others, resolving to repay that kindness, inspiring a sort of a reciprocity of affection, generating loving kindness, inspiring a recognition of the value of others being happy. Great compassion, inspiring recognition that all sentient beings deserve to be free from the all-pervasive suffering of samsara. The wholehearted resolve, inspiring within us an intention to free others, to help them become free. And lastly, the aspiration, inspiring us to give our life over to this intention to awaken.
That's a nice way of putting it, giving our life over to this, because otherwise it seems like, the aspiration is some far impossible thing that we'll never get to.
Yeah, and also if it's like the thing, I wish to become enlightened, but I've got these other things to do.
I just got to do this other thing first.
That's right. I've just got to do this and this and this. That just shows that we haven't actually given our life over to this intention. And the other things will come, but my life is about this.
So
waking up.
So Anne's saying, for instance, I just got to clean the stove first, or I'm just thinking of every single excuse we can make for how we don't have time to come to class.
Yeah, or to become familiar with a spiritual path. So our next one, equalizing centric self for others. Here they are again. So equalizing self for others means acknowledging that we both have a wish to be happy. We both have a wish to be free from suffering. We are the same there. Looking at the faults of egocentricity, the faults of self-importance. The benefits of actually caring for others, cherishing them, holding them dearly. And in exchanging self with others means exchanging the view that we've had that we are the most important. Exchanging that with going, no, others are more important. And then giving and taking means having the courage, inspiring the courage to give away the sense of self-concern and take on the responsibility of freeing others from suffering. Now, like I said, what really stops both of the techniques and really keeps self-grasping alive and well is something called self-cherishing. So let's have a look at what that is.
So Eddie, just before you go on with the equalizing and exchanging self and others, I mean, to a degree, parents do this, don't they? When they become parents, then suddenly they've swapped the view around. Instead of my life the most important, now, the baby's life.
Yeah, that's right. Important. That's right. And there is an exchange. That's right. That's right. And that's why the mother is used so often as the main example.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons, because mothers do this naturally, so it shows this can be done,
and it's also a natural thing to do.
That's right. When you see how much the baby needs you, how much they suffer, how they actually need you, you're willing to put them ahead of you. So and then we forget actually we need others to become enlightened. If the need is still there. But we have become self-important. We have forgotten that. And so we cherish our sense of self. Now, what is it? What is this thing? So here, I just come across this wonderful information in a book called In Praise of Great Compassion by the Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron that describes what self-cherishing actually is and what it's not. And like for you, Sue, this is the clearest I've ever come across this. I mean, I've heard it said in classes Well, it's never been as clear as this. So it's called an inferior obscuration and is a hindrance for bodhisattvas to abandon. So to support this, what I've put up there, because it's a little bit difficult to write to, you know, what can I actually say here? So there's a number of different names for self-cherishing. Here I'm going to use the word self-centered. Right? So the self-centered or the self-cherishing attitude is neither an afflictive nor a cognitive obscuration. So those of you who have studied a bit will know that, you know, we've basically got these two obscurations. One set are called afflictive. They prevent your liberation from cyclic existence. If you could get rid of all the afflictive obscurations, you could be an arahat, or hearer, or a solitary realizer. But you're not, you can't be a Buddha. People who wish to become Buddhas need to remove two obscurations, the afflictive and cognitive. Here it's saying the self-centered attitude is not an afflictive obscuration and it is not a cognitive obscuration. It is not a pollutant or a defilement, nor is it the root of cyclic existence. It's often called an inferior obscuration that those following the bodhisattva path must prevent, because it impedes their attainment of the non-abiding nirvana of a Buddha. Although the self-centered attitude is called an obscuration, it's not an actual obscuration, because it's not the object of abandonment of a path, as the afflictive and cognitive obscurations are. However, it is a hindrance for the bodhisattvas to abandon.
Okay, so can we have that in plain English, please?
Well, I think that is really plain. That is plain. That's the simplest, you know, and most obvious to me that I've come across. So now there are two types of self-cherishing. One is negative and one is not. So the first thing is, like, it's not a cognitive obscuration. It's not an afflictive obscuration. Yet self-cherishing is of two types, one that's negative and one that's not. The negative type of self-cherishing is entwined within self-grasping ignorance, or the root of cyclic existence. So we have misapprehended the aggregates, the parts of our body and mind, to be a me. Not just the name given to the aggregates, but to be the same, to be me. In response to that, there's a cherishing of that. Now, there's a sense of self-preoccupation with this I grasped by ignorance. So that's the negative type of self-cherishing. Now, those of the Mahayana persuasion will say that those people who have realized, you know, the state of a hearer, arahat, or a solitary realizer, have brought about the lesser enlightenment. Those people still have self-cherishing. So then you're going to go, okay, what type of self-cherishing do they have? Because it's not an afflictive type of self-cherishing, because if it were, they could not be who they are. So what they're saying is the cherishing is that I am more important, that they're just focused on my own personal liberation. They've cherished themselves more than others. And they have, haven't they?
So they've cherished themselves more, but they haven't actually harmed anybody.
No, they haven't. The self-cherishing is not entwined with harm or self-grasping or any of the afflictive emotions. It's just centered on your own welfare. Anyway, I just wanted to bring this up, of course, and like I say, to suggest that this is in the book, and Praise of Great Compassion. There's a lot of really good material there when you start digging in deeper to find out what is self-cherishing and so forth. And like I said, sometimes, like it has been explained in classes, but of course it's often got to go through a translator and then through us. So it's never actually been like clear to me. I've never ever heard a teacher say, look, it's not a cognitive obscuration and it's not an afflictive obscuration. And for me, the natural thing is to go, well, there are these two obscurations. If it's not afflictive, then it must be cognitive. And here they're saying, no, it's not. I guess that's what I would like you to remember. It's called an obscuration, but it's not actually an obscuration. That's why it's called inferior. It's only an obscuration in relationship to those people who wish to become Buddhas. Right? Because to become a Buddha, you have to cherish others. Cherishing others is more important than cherishing self. If you cherish self greater than you cherish others, you will not attain Buddhahood. And that's the hindrance. So next, cherishing others, what is it? An understanding and affectionate response to the needs of others. So remember, before, like, we understand our own suffering, we have an affectionate response to our own suffering. You know, we call it being kind to oneself, wishing to be free from suffering, developing all the right causes and so on, you know, for our own needs. We just extend it across and go, well, everyone's, you know, they're all persons, they're just like me. I understand that their suffering is just like mine. I've looked at through these methods, how much they've helped me, how much they've supported me. So we have affection for them. And then we respond to their needs, which are to be free of suffering, to be happy, to be, you know, authentically happy. So that's what cherishing others is about. So here we have now this table of the 11 points, and I've written these out. So, you know, what each one does. So we have a visual equanimity, we remove the bias, and balance social reactivity. All beings as kin, inspiring commonality and solidarity, remembering kindness, inspiring gratitude, repaying kindness, repaying affection, sameness of self and others, empathy. Disadvantages of egocentricity brings about renunciation and compassion. Advantages of cherishing others, inspiring affectionate love. Exchanging self for others, courage. Taking suffering, so in giving everything lovely, the practice of giving, of taking and giving. Courageous compassion and selfless love. The wholehearted resolve is, you know, taking on this responsibility and having purpose. And with radical altruism, the mind of enlightenment itself is action. We have to act on this.
What's great about this list, Eddie, is that looking on the right-hand column, all the things that, you know, we just wish we could develop, like, you know, gratitude or love, yeah. And then here is what to do to get there.
That's right. That's why I want to put this up. It's like cause and effect, cause and, yeah. If so you do this, you get this.
If we want, you know, just looking at like number 8 with courage, if we want to be courageous, the very best possible cause for that is exchanging self for others, putting ourselves in their shoes and, you know, having their, you know, benefit more important than ours.
That's right.
And that's true. That's how you get over stage fright and shyness and all sorts of things.
Yep, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, so this list here, I took through, sifting through these lists in a book called Gradual Awakening by Miles Neal. So that's, like I said, a really wonderful commentary on three principal aspects of the path, but from a sort of through a psychological lens. So this is why all these things are really important here, you know, to develop these psychological states that are really good for us. And, you know, to really spell it out. That was the other thing I liked in that book. It just spells out clearly, which is not always the case when you hear things. Okay, so we've come to the end of our class today. We've looked at some of these topics, and they're all, of course, engaged with the advanced level of practitioner, the person on the great scope, trying to develop the mind of enlightenment. And we looked at verses 6 and 7. So verse 6 was talking about the importance of bodhicitta. Verse 7 was talking about the methods for its development. And in the presentation of the class, and in your listening to it and engaging it, we've covered two questions in the suggested public exam, questions 9 and 10. And in terms of the other assessment questions, we covered 12, 13 and 14.
Just say suggested exam.
Courage, folks. Courage.
You're going to be
a bodhisattva in public, remember? In public, not just in your room imagining it.
This is not my exam. This is the exam for sentient beings.
Look, have a look at these pages 22 to 27 in the FPMT readings. And there's a meditation on bodhicitta there that you can also have a crack at. Verses 6 and 7 of the three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment. Try and memorize these and use whichever version you are most comfortable with. And coming up, we'll be having looking at more practices within this advanced level next week, which really is sort of based around this giving and taking practice. And we'll also look at the perfections. And so we've basically come to the end of our class. Is there anything anybody would like to finally ask before we dedicate our efforts and understandings?
Nothing yet.
Okay. So we have created some, you know, virtuous energy here. We've put time into it. You've all been listening. I'm sure you've all been thinking about it. So that's what we call a merit. So we want to direct that merit towards a goal. And the best, very best goal we could dedicate it towards is waking up. To wake up, we need a mind that aspires to do so. So I'd want to dedicate it to us developing the authentic mind of enlightenment so that we can become fully awakened and bring about a natural, spontaneous sense of being that helps others. So I dedicate our merit towards that goal and towards the long lives of our teachers to the end of COVID, but not a return to the normalcy of cyclic existence. With the knowledge that all of these merits exist dependently, and so therefore are without any true existence, therefore can actually produce their result. So maybe become fully enlightened, thereby paying the kindness of our teachers and all sentient beings. And may this enlightenment be for the sake of others. And may it come about as quickly as possible. Yeah. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Eddie. And please, everyone, turn on your video so Eddie can see who is here.
Hey, Nicola. Sue, good to see you again. Anthea, rock on. June, great to see you. And Deb. Yeah, very nice to see all your faces again. How are you, Deb? And Maria. Okay. Well, good luck this week. enjoy yourselves and try and, you know, bring a bit of mind of enlightenment into it. Everything will get better then. Okay.
All you courageous people turning on
your camera, right.
Fantastic, good on you.
Yeah.
And those of you shy lurking in the back of the room, we don't
behind the black of the screen. Hi, Anne. Okay, folks, lovely to see you all. Thank you for being here, and we'll see you again later. Bye-bye then.